Hi, and welcome to Amicus. This is Slate's podcast about the courts and the law and a Supreme Court that never comes up for air anymore. Even as it journeys back and forth between the modern day and the Gilded Age, riding atop a zombie law that was once aimed at obscenity, but gives them a chance to maybe create a national abortion ban. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I cover the courts and the law at Slate, and all eyes were on SCOTUS on Tuesday morning for a lengthy oral argument about Mifepristone. That's the case we previewed on last week's show with Carrie Baker. Not a ton of surprises in the arguments, beyond the fact that Justices Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas were brave enough to embrace that 1873 Comstock Act, although somehow they weren't quite brave enough to name it.
Shouldn't the FDA have at least considered the application of 18 U.S.C. 1461?
So I think that the Comstock provisions don't fall within FDA's lane.
This week, our Slate Plus listeners are going to get to hang out with Mark Joseph Stern and me in our bonus segment as we don our members-only jackets and talk about the good news and the bad news from that Mifepristone argument. And we're going to check back in on Texas's efforts to write its own immigration law while the appeals courts get whiplash. If you are not a Slate Plus member, you can listen to this whole episode ad-free and replete with Mark's incisive wit by becoming a member right now. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts by clicking Try Free at the top of our show page, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. And to our Slate Plus members and supporters, thank you, thank you, thank you. This is a show we probably should have brought you 10 years ago, but also it could work again in a week or the week after. We're going to take a look at the phenomenon called RAGA, or the Republican Attorneys General Association. It's a little old tax-exempt group that represents over half the state's chief legal officers. And yes, RAGA does rhyme with MAGA, and its members are on the front lines of just about every single important legal movement in the country. And while its moves and its funding are directed, of course, by your favorite teeny little monopoly money man, dark money guy, Leonard Leo, this group receives almost no sustained public attention. Why? Perhaps for the same reason we've been gathering string to do a RAGA show for so long. They are ghosts. They are everywhere and nowhere. We decided to tackle the Phantom Menace on today's show because this past week was one of those times it became briefly visible to the naked eye. As reported in Politico last weekend, RAGA had stepped into efforts to run out a D.C. official who dared investigate Leonard Leo, and they've been pushing anti-abortion laws that will be heard at the Supreme Court in the forthcoming EMTALA cases. And of course, there were a whole bunch of RAGA interventions when it came to the efforts to set aside the results of the 2020 election. And the thing is, once you train your focus on this group, they just keep popping up over and over again. This is a lot of stringboard in this show, yes, but once you see the patterns, you kind of can't unsee them. We're asking our friend Lisa Graves to help us trace RAGA's trajectory, the issues it's touched, the places it's going, how the whole outfit works. Lisa has been watching RAGA's rise for two decades. She is founder and executive director of True North Research, a national watchdog group that works to shine light on the dark money fueling regressive agendas, targeting the courts and democracy. Lisa served as deputy assistant attorney general in the Office of Policy Development at the Justice Department under attorneys general Janet Reno and John Ashcroft, and she served as chief counsel for nominations for Senator Patrick Leahy in the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee. Lisa, I want to welcome you back. The last time we had you on the show, ostensibly to talk about Leonard Leo and dark money, we just kept veering into RAGA territory and we never quite fleshed it out. So today, congratulations. Is RAGA Day.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be on, Dahlia. It's a joy to be on your show and looking forward to this conversation.
Can you just tell us the Schoolhouse Rock version of what a state attorney general is meant to do?
Yes, each state has their own attorney general, and those attorneys general are the top law enforcement officer, in essence, in the state. Their job is to protect the interests of the people of the state, particularly consumers, of the state, and they usually have a pretty significant staff, and their primary job is to help ensure that the laws of the state, including environmental laws, protections for people's clean water, clean air, against pollution and more, that those laws are enforced. And so these elections come up from time to time, often in presidential election years, but not always. There will be a position on your ballot to vote for this top law enforcement official in your state. And that job on the surface is one that is important to protecting the rights of people in each state. But in many ways, in my opinion, over the past 25 years, that role has been redirected and distorted in large part due to the efforts of Leonard Leo, who you mentioned. And it's a significant redirection in a way that has had, I think, a grotesquely distorting effect on public policy and our rights.
And am I inventing this sunny history in which I'm old enough to remember, Lisa, that actually attorneys general were kind of nonpartisan? They were kind of apt to work across political lines, as you said, for the interests of the residents of the state, that they were not really, I think, imagined as sort of a turbocharged partisan political office, and that that starts to change. And ironically, in some ways, it starts to change around environmental law and deregulatory efforts.
Your recollection is correct, although they've always been offices where people run on a partisan ticket, but they have not, until the past quarter century, they have not been really deployed in general as political officers or political agents or operatives. And that change really began in 1999, because before that, there was a group that all state attorneys general belonged to, the National Association of Attorneys General, NAG. And it was a bipartisan, transpartisan group, a group of all the state attorneys general conferring about the practices in their state and cases that transcend jurisdiction. And so there was a significant set of lawsuits in the 1990s around tobacco, because there had been a long-standing effort by the tobacco industry to deny the carcinogenic effects of smoking and its other products, and to basically lie to the American people, despite the fact that the tobacco companies knew full well that their products did cause cancer, had a tendency toward causing cancer, and in some ways had materials that enhanced that threat. Just to pause for a second on the history of that, one of the things that has had a fundamentally disruptive effect on U.S. law and U.S. policy in the past more than 50 years is that a then tobacco lawyer named Lewis Powell wrote a thing called the Powell Memo. That Powell Memo was written to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and it was this quite absurd, in my opinion, claim that businesses had too little influence on American law circa 1971. There was, in the preceding decade, a recent spate of environmental regulation to protect against rivers that were on fire and smokestacks and pollution, in addition to efforts to try to regulate smoking, which was causing an epidemic of cancer. And so the tobacco lawyer, Lewis Powell, wrote a memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce basically saying businesses need to get more involved in policy and lobbying and universities and more in order to change our laws to benefit corporations. He was rewarded shortly after his memo to the chamber with an appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court. And so that's 1971. Fast forward to 1991. Finally, there is a real concerted effort by attorneys generals across the country, although not every attorney general, but many attorneys general, to hold the tobacco industry liable for the consequences to people's lives, but also to our healthcare system. As that was ongoing, the Republican attorneys general decided to create their own attorney general association to pursue their own agenda and actually raise money from industry, from the industries that they were supposed to regulate in order to fund this operation, which was designed to basically fuel their campaigns. And I can talk about that more in a moment. But this history is deeply embedded in antipathy to public regulation, government regulation of industries that have literally killed thousands, if not millions, of Americans in the form of the tobacco industry, for example.
Okay, so just to summarize, the 1970s backlash to attempts to regulate polluters, it bursts the Powell Memo, which in turn births a whole new era of big corporate money seeking to influence law, lawmakers, and law officers. Enter RAGA, when, Lisa, did you first clock the way Republican attorneys general were slotting into this picture?
So after they created RAGA in 1999, I first learned of it when I was on the Senate Judiciary Committee when I was Senator Leahy's chief counsel on nominations, and a whistleblower came to us with the call records, basically the call list for these attorneys general to make, to call industry, to ask them for money, money that they could not raise themselves. They couldn't ask a corporation to fund their personal political campaign, but they were using RAGA, fund RAGA, and then RAGA would collect it and then pass it into their campaigns. So it was a way for them to get power. It was a way for them to get money that they couldn't otherwise raise due to state campaign finance laws, raise it through RAGA, have it be aggregated and then basically disaggregated, not one-to-one, but like the money was flowing through RAGA to help their campaigns. At the time that that whistleblower came forward to the Senate Judiciary Committee, it was because there was a nominee who was the head of RAGA at the time. His name is Bill Pryor. I know you've heard of him because he's attacked you and attacked anyone who's dared to speak out about the money that has just been pumping through the system. He was the head of RAGA, and he was up for a nomination to the 11th Circuit. But those documents didn't just include calls from Bill Pryor, who's now a judge, shaking down industry basically for funds for RAGA to help support their future elections. It also included John Cornyn, who had been a former attorney general of Texas and who was on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And it came out of Alabama. And so, of course, Senator Sessions was at the heart of this, making heated attacks on how dare we expose RAGA. So that's when I first heard of RAGA. It was wrapped within a thing called the Republican State Leadership Committee, RSLC, which also was pretty obscure at the time and later became much more famous because of REDMAP, their effort to basically capture the state legislatures during the 2010 election in order to rewrite the maps, in order to help themselves get reelected, in essence, indefinitely, through changing the maps to choose who votes for them. And so RAGA was within RSLC. RAGA was actively raising money from regulated industries in huge sums. A person who then became a lifetime appointee to the 11th Circuit was at the helm of that operation. Other people were part of that, including John Cornyn. The Republicans shut down that investigation, but I've never forgotten what happened then because that group, that RAGA group, as you mentioned, continued to grow, continued to raise money from industries that otherwise should have been regulated by these attorneys general. And in 2014, the year that that article you mentioned by Eric Lipton of the New York Times came out, that was the year that RAGA left RSLC to form its own 527 organization under the tax code. As you point out, that's a nonprofit, a group. It doesn't pay any income tax on the revenue. And then that money is spun out into supporting these attorneys general. Since 2014, since it's become its own separate 527, the largest supporter by far of RAGA has been Leonard Leo's network. So 2014, that article comes out in the New York Times talking about how these attorneys general are cozying up to industry. Subsequent to that story, my organization, the organization I led, the Center for Media and Democracy, which I'm still the president of the board of, we did a number of FOIA requests for records from these attorneys general about their communications with industry, with the American Legislative Exchange Council, with other groups. We obtained a number of documents that included price sheets about how much it costs to get before these attorneys general, to go to their conferences, to have a table, to have a panel, to have a presentation. And when you look at those documents that are available at the Center for Media Democracy's website, what you see is that RAGA is a pay-to-play operation, and it's paying to play with some of the biggest corporations in America. And they want something for that, and that is manifested in these briefs, in these positions that these RAGA attorneys general take in our states and before our state and federal courts.
I had to pause to sigh. So this is, in some sense, Lisa, if it is familiar to listeners, the scandal that broke earlier this year about the Koch brothers having kind of secret conclaves and flying out Justice Clarence Thomas and having like the big donors get to come to the like super, super secret, you know, smoky backroom event at those conferences with Justice Thomas. It's exactly the same kind of pay to play, access to the biggest players, except I guess it comes with a price list, which is nice. It's good to know that it's like the hotel minibar, how much it costs to pay to play what game. But there's the Leonard Leo piece in the middle of this, which is also just incredibly familiar. And this is your job. Follow the money. So help us understand who's paying to play and who are they paying and where does that money go?
I mean, it really is shocking that Leonard Leo's network is the largest funder of RAGA. There are corporations that have funded RAGA, you know, Coke Industries, tobacco companies, energy companies, and the like. And we've got a full list. We can send a link to attach to it, or at least the most recent list that we have from tax filings. But this pay-to-play thing is so troubling because, again, these are state attorneys general, and their job is supposed to be to enforce the law. And one of the things I discovered in some of my research about Leonard Leo was that there's this group called the Judicial Education Project, and it is now known as the 85 Fund because these names are all like disposable names for them. But back then, it was called the Judicial Education Project, and we've been looking into it in part because it's the group that Leonard Leo used to pay Jenny Thomas secretly through Kellyanne Conway's firm from a secret donor that was after Harlan Crowe staked Jenny Thomas with $500,000 to fund her group, Liberty Central, at the time that the Citizens United decision was pending. So we were looking into this timeline. There's a very important investigation that Heidi Presbilla did to really examine that, and then we've examined it as well. And what you see is this group that has deployed to basically pay Jenny Thomas secretly. When it starts paying Jenny Thomas secretly, it starts filing amicus briefs. And it notes in its filing that it's paying particular attention to the potential of the state of West Virginia to have a new attorney general who became the attorney general who was basically deployed to attack the Clean Power Plan, Patrick Morrissey. So among all the things that are happening, here's a group that is intimately tied to Leonard Leo, Leonard Leo's operation. It's the group he trusts to get the money into the hands of Jenny Thomas, the wife of a sitting Supreme Court justice, secretly. It's a group that is then focusing at that time, circa 2010, 2011, 2012, on the election of a particular attorney general, investigating what the powers of the attorney general of West Virginia might be. And then Morrissey gets elected and he becomes the tip of the spear in attacking the effort by the Obama administration to write rules, reasonable rules, about power plants to try to direct some more of those power plant efforts into climate mitigation. And that nexus, it's a Leo group. It comes exactly at the time that we know Leo becomes one of the most significant funders of RAGA as it becomes an independent 527 in 2014. And they're already immediately spotlighting how can they use West Virginia to advance this agenda that then, you know, you have to watch this for so long because fast forward 8 years from RAGA's separate creation in 2014, suddenly in 2022, just as the court is destroying Roe and overturning Roe versus Wade and the Dobbs decision, in that same term, the court is saying you can regulate basically women's bodies, but you can't regulate corporations to force these utilities to at least put some of their money into renewable energy under the Clean Power Plan. But in that term, the court decided you can't regulate corporations, but you can regulate women's bodies. And RAGA AGs were involved in both of those cases. And so it is really full circle. It is a sort of surround sound in terms of their intention and their focus. And this story, the reason I wanted to tell it is because it does show like how long this plan is in place before its major victories with this Leo-packed Supreme Court, with these attorneys general whose jobs they owe Leo because he spent so much money funding RAGA that then fund their campaigns, then they turn around and pursue cases before this court that advance the agenda that he has basically set forth at the Federal Society and through other groups.
Let's take a short break. Now more with Lisa Graves of True North Research. So Lisa, you're describing two moves that I think are both invisible to the naked eye, but everywhere, as has become the theme of this show. One is what we see as a kind of one-way vector. Leonard Leo's Supreme Court is in fact a triangle, right? Because the third vector is to the state AGs who are bringing these cases, who are making promises, who are as much a part of this deregulatory agenda and this anti-choice agenda and this anti-LGBTQ agenda as the court itself. They're the kind of flying monkeys. They're the worker bees, I guess, aspiring to someday be on the court. And we'll talk about that in a second. The other thing is that this is a move that is so disaggregated from state welfare and state politics. We're now doing just straight up partisan Republican Party politics. And for me, that turn is really evident in terms of Raga's participation in the events of January 6th, where, you know, suddenly we have, I mean, it's unbelievable the scope of Raga's involvement in something that has nothing to do with Republican AGs. So we've got like a sister organization sending out a robocall in advance of the insurrection, urging the, quote, patriots to join the rally on the Ellipse and promising, quote, we will march to the Capitol building and call on Congress to stop the steal. And there's like money forked over and Raga is up to their neck in it. And I want you to talk about that, but I also want you to talk about it through the lens of, like, for a minute, there's actual accountability. And we actually have a light that shines for a few weeks at least, not just on what Raga was doing involving itself in trying to set aside the election, but who the players were and what corporations were pouring money into that. So can you do, like, kind of the two-step on that?
Yes. So that's a really horrifying and true story, as you've described it, Dahlia. So Raga has had an arm called the Rule of Law Defense Fund, RLDF. Now, rule of law is a term that these right-wingers throw around that does not mean to them, I think, what it means to the rest of us, because they routinely deploy it in ways that seem to be inconsistent with the law on the books or the precedents on the books. And this Rule of Law Defense Fund was deployed to do robocalls to urge people to go to the January 6th events that Trump said would be wild, you know, go there on the day that Congress was supposed to be certifying the election. And as he was mounting this intimidation campaign against Pence, unleashing his followers to assail him. And also, you know, this is in the context of weeks of efforts by Trump and his lawyers and advisors, not all of them, but the ones who were trying to help him execute what I consider to be a coup. You had the state attorneys general of, you know, the United States actively involved in some of this litigation to try to stop other states from certifying the election. Texas was involved in the person of its attorney general, and the governor, you know, was involved in that effort to basically say that other states, their votes shouldn't count. So you had some of these state AGs that are part of Raga were involved in litigation. The group itself, through this Rule of Law Defense Fund, was actively involved in peddling the big lie, which I call the big lucrative lie, by the way, but the big lie about the election to push people to go to the mall on January 6th. And a group that I co-founded, but I wasn't leading at the time, called Documented, broke that story of those robocalls by the Rule of Law Defense Fund, by Raga. There was sort of shock and horror that a group of state attorneys general would be involved in essence, trying to aid the precursor events to the violent insurrection at the Capitol. And companies said they weren't going to fund Raga. They, you know, regretted this, or they, you know, disavowed it. And so for a moment there, there was a bright light shining on Raga and on the events around the Capitol and these AGs. But then, like you said, months later, some of those companies came back to fund Raga. So the accountability light was on and then off. The companies that were funding Raga in 2020, in addition to Leonard Leo's network, were Koch Industries, Comcast, Walmart, Home Depot, Amazon, TikTok, 1-800-CONTACT, Chevron, the National Rifle Association, Monsanto, Facebook, Fox, Uber, Coca-Cola, Exxon, and Google were some of the main funders of Raga at that time. And so there was, you know, some pushback. Of course, it didn't last. And it didn't last. And the effect of that not lasting is not just that Leonard Leo continues to be the biggest subsidizer of Raga through the money that is coming through his network, but it's also the case that facing no consequences, basically allowing them to just get away with it by letting go of the guy in charge of the Rule of Law Defense Fund, means that they are, in essence, unrepentant. There's been no consequence for them. And the Rule of Law Defense Fund still exists. Raga still exists. And many of these attorneys general have been actively involved in other efforts that make it harder for Americans to vote and they may well be involved this fall in a repeat of 2020 in terms of their efforts to protect Trump at any cost.
And you mentioned, Lisa, that Texas's AG, Ken Paxton, the mayor of Ragatown, although there are so many mayors, brings this emergency motion to the U.S. Supreme Court trying to set aside the vote in four other states that Biden had won. We had 17 Raga Republican attorneys general sign on to that brief. This is an election that the actual United States Attorney General Bill Barr had repeatedly said there's no fraud here, and these guys knew better and got in on the action on pressuring the court. And I just want to point out, because you noted, like, you got to sort of fast forward, these same Raga actors somehow are neck deep in the Trump immunity suit at the Supreme Court now.
They have continued to attack our democracy in a variety of ways, attack elections, our election process in a variety of ways, and even defend, again, the indefensible. This notion that Trump has some sort of unlimited immunity, or this very broad conception of immunity, if they even concede, you know, some boundaries, it somehow doesn't apply here. It again goes back to this notion that they claim to be adherents to the rule of law. And yet the immunity case reveals, in essence, the lie of that, in my opinion. Because if the rule of law means anything, it means that a president is not above the law. And in particular, in this instance, a president who sought to, in my view, commit a cardinal sin in our democracy, which is to try to overturn the legitimate results of the election of 2020, an election that swept into office other people in the Senate and the House who joined him in his efforts to try to subvert the election. They were on the same ballot, but yet were contesting the fact that Trump lost and that he was willing to incite an insurrection in order to accomplish his will. And these attorneys general who claim to abide by the rule of law are willing time and time again to do his bidding to, in my view, ruin, wreck, undermine our democracy, and with it, our freedoms.
So this sweeps in Leonard Leo, too, because if we're right that that Raga's actions are sort of the third leg of the stool, then clearly all those puff pieces from the winter about the great distance between Leo's agenda and Donald Trump's and how they weren't, you know, there was a time when they wouldn't make eye contact at Mar-a-Lago and awkwardness ensued. I mean, these are Leonard Leo's foot soldiers who are presumably all in for MAGA, for Project 2025, for whatever the Heritage Foundation is doing. There's no distance to be found between Leonard Leo's project and Raga's project and Donald Trump's project when he wins in 2024. I'm sorry, should he win in 2024?
Well, that's right. I mean, I read those stories closely. They seemed to be very favorably, sort of perhaps even placed. I don't know. I could speculate. What's the source of the intel that Leonard Leo didn't make eye contact with Trump? It's probably not Trump, let's just say. But regardless of the sourcing of those stories, there's been this PR campaign to create some distance. But there is no distance on the real policy. The real policy, this agenda to use the Supreme Court to strip us of our rights, to use the court to make it harder for us to deal with climate change, to use the court to roll back reproductive rights, gay marriage, and more. These are all part and parcel of Leo's agenda, and these attorneys general are on that agenda. And Trump, despite his efforts to try to maneuver himself around the abortion and the IVF issue, you know, he is the author of that by basically deferring to Leo in who gets on the Supreme Court. But I guess there's a couple parts there that I think are worth thinking about. One is, you know, one of the things that was happening in the past decade was that we know that Barry Side, who's the Chicago billionaire who ultimately gave Leo control of a $1.6 billion trust fund to deploy at his will, Barry Side was also secretly funding briefs by who? Republican attorneys general. We helped document that in 2020 during the Amy Coney Barrett hearings, helped show the role of the Bradley Foundation, also in funneling some of that money toward briefs, not just by Republican attorneys general, but by Republican senators sitting on the Judiciary Committee. And so there was an effort by Leo's billionaire benefactor to help fund cases that advance Leo's agenda. And then ultimately in 2020, after Leo gets somehow dramatically richer, seemingly greater assets, and I just have to say this because I can't ever get it out of my head, after Kennedy announced his retirement from the Supreme Court in the summer of 2018, Leonard Leo paid off his own, Leonard Leo's mortgage on his home 22 years early. That fall, on the eve of the vote for Kavanaugh, on the cloture vote day, Leonard Leo buys a $3 million mansion in Maine with $2 million in a mortgage and $1 million cash, basically. Hours before the vote to confirm Kavanaugh, he's still working at the Federal Society. In that same year, one of his right-hand men at the Federal Society, Jonathan Bunch, received more than $1 million to one of these groups that Leo had created. He was also a vice president of the Federal Society. So you have Leo himself and the people around Leo getting a lot of money from people who were interested, I suppose, in what they were doing to the courts. And then Leo stays on at the Federal Society through 2019. The Washington Post writes this amazing expose detailing these facts, this financial boon that Leo seemingly has received while he's been playing this role packing the courts. And after that report comes out, later that year, Leo decides to leave the Federal Society and create CRC Advisors and announces in January of 2020 that he is continuing to stay on the board of the Federal Society, which is a group of, you know, right-wing lawyers that he has used as his stable for, you know, putting people in these pipelines to power, attorney general positions, federal courts, lower courts, the Supreme Court. We learn years later, 2 years later, 3 years later, I guess now for real, that Leo also received this gift of $1.6 billion in a trust fund from Barry Side, who was his compatriot, in essence, or his benefactor in helping to fund Raga briefs to the U.S. Supreme Court. I know it sounds like a conspiracy theory, but it's true. These are all documented components of this agenda. And the idea, I guess, to come back to your original question is, in some ways, Leonard Leo doesn't need to be friendly with Donald Trump anymore. He's got what he wanted. He has a court that has six Republican appointees on it with a reliable vote, in essence, for his long-term agenda, and that court could remain in power for 20 to 30 years, at least a five-vote majority, unless there are significant reforms that are pushed through by Congress and signed into law by a president. So he has captured the U.S. Supreme Court. He doesn't need to be buddies with Donald Trump. He can use Trump to accomplish his agenda. He can deploy his friends in all these different pipelines to continue to advance his agenda. And Trump is not a detail-oriented guy that way. He has been more than willing to go with the plan on a variety of these substantive issues and let the people who are the conciliaries, the advisors, the buddies, the friends of Leo have their way.
We are going to pause now to hear from some of our great sponsors on this week's show. Let's return now to my conversation with Lisa Graves of True North Research. I have to ask you about Emtala, in part because this week the court heard a mifepristone case. I think we can all agree it did not go well for the folks who wanted to see mifepristone banned nationwide for all time. But Emtala is a huge big deal. And this is the other abortion case that's coming next month at the court. And this is a case that can similarly really, really jeopardize and undermine abortion care throughout the country. And I wonder if you would just talk to us for one little minute, because, of course, Raga's sticky little fingers are all over Emtala, too.
Yes. So you have, again, some of these state attorneys general who are involved in amicus briefs in this case. And you have a person who is now the attorney general for Idaho who has spearheaded that effort. His name is Raul Labrador. He was formerly part of the Freedom Caucus when he was in Congress. He was seemingly sort of picked to take over the state AG role in Idaho over a Republican who, you know, apparently maybe was not playing enough ball with the powers that be. So he won a few years ago to become the Attorney General of Idaho, decided after Dobbs, after that decision, that he was going to be imposing his personal views against abortion as a matter of law, basically as the Attorney General, but that he somehow didn't have the legal capacity to do it himself. So as Law Dork reported, he contracted with the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is a group that the Southern Poverty Law Center has called a hate group and which is employs Aaron Hawley, who made the argument before the court this week attacking Mifepristone. So basically, the Attorney General of Idaho, who is a lawyer, who has lawyers who work for the state of Idaho, decided that he was going to use Idaho taxpayer dollars to hire the Alliance Defending Freedom to defend the state of Idaho, as if they don't have their own attorneys, in its efforts to not comply with the federal regulations under EMTALA, which that statute has been around for a long time, and it relates to hospitals not being able to turn people away who need care. Like, the root of that is, if you're in an emergency situation, basically you can't be dumped, you can't be thrown out of a hospital. Hospitals have to provide you emergency care. In this instance, as you know, and as your listeners know, this regulation has been extended by the Biden administration in response to Dobbs to make sure that women, pregnant people whose health is at risk, they come to present themselves at an emergency room, that they have a right to have their health protected. And Idaho has a law on the books that bars abortion except for if someone's life is in danger, and that has been sort of interpreted to be at the brink of death. But EMTALA says you don't have to wait to the brink of death to save someone, to give someone an abortion who needs one, emergency care, because they're in the middle of a miscarriage or they have another health reason to need an abortion. But Idaho doesn't want to apply that law and has sought out the U.S. Supreme Court with the help of Aaron Hawley and Alliance Defending Freedom to take that case to the U.S. Supreme Court. And that case is really, it really presents, again, like, it pierces through the rhetoric that these people who are advancing these extreme anti-abortion laws actually care about the health of women, because they're basically saying they refuse to follow this federal regulation that is designed to protect the health of people who are pregnant when they present themselves in an emergency room, because these people, like Raul Labrador, believe that their personal view on abortion, embodied in the law of Idaho, should only allow someone to get an abortion if they're in the basically at the brink of death, not in order to protect their health at any earlier point.
Last question, and then we will say goodbye, although I could talk to you for two more hours. We have now said in 100 different ways. I've got like 50 tabs on my screen, Lisa, telling Raga stories. Raga is everywhere. There's no issue that we have talked about it on this show over the years that doesn't have a Raga angle. How is it possible that a pay-to-play operation that vaults people who are AGs, nobody wants to be a state AG forever, this vaults them into positions of power with access, with huge amounts of money they couldn't otherwise raise in order to do the bidding of Leonard Leo? Why has this not caught on as not just like a salient issue, but one of the single most salient issues that people who are worried about the Supreme Court reasonably, who are worried about dark money reasonably, who are worried about voter suppression and the corruption of democracy? How come Raga isn't at the top of the bill for stuff that they should be thinking about going into an election that is really precarious?
Well, in some ways, Raga operates as it's designed to do, as the sort of shield to keep the names of the attorneys general out of the public, you know, press in the ways that they don't want it to be tied to that money-raising component. They just want their AGs to be appearing in press releases, you know, announcing their wins or announcing their briefs or what have you. But I really do think it's a vitally important story for people to understand the role that these state AGs are playing. And there's a couple things if you'll indulge me, to just add into that equation. One is, as you point out, these are stepping stones. And so one of the sets of research that we looked into was, who has Leonard Leo been helping early in their careers through the Federal Society, through other means to advance them? And so, for example, Ken Paxton, when he was facing indictment, now, of course, that case has been settled, it seems, but as he was becoming Attorney General of Texas, he announced who his advisors were. Who was there for Ken Paxton? Leonard Leo. We looked into other AGs that, where did they get their start? How did they get into power? Oh, it turns out that Josh Hawley, when he was moving over from being a professor into running for the attorney general job for the state of Missouri, who was helping to stake him? Who was apparently walking him around? Leonard Leo and his key operatives involved in Judicial Education Project were named around his attorney general role and the controversy about him becoming attorney general. Of course, then he became a U.S. senator, so it was indeed a stepping stone. And then his wife has also then been elevated into this role where She not only is a counsel for the Alliance Defending Freedom and arguing for the court to help destroy our rights, but she also was the person who helped write the Mississippi abortion law at issue in the Dobbs case. And so his fingerprints really are in significant places, and people do need to understand that. But the other part of that is, in my opinion, some of these attorneys general are so dangerous that it's actually shocking to me. Because what you have is, for example, with Greg Abbott, it's not just that Greg Abbott is the governor of Texas and he's engaged in this sort of political warfare to elevate his potential future role or run for office. He's being advised by that state attorney general, Ken Paxton, about what he can or cannot do and what he will or will not defend in terms of Texas's claims. In the immigration context, you have this outlandish assertion that the state of Texas has the right to supersede federal immigration law, which, again, on this notion of what does the rule of law mean? What is the law? The Constitution, you know, is quite clear that the federal government has the power over immigration. It's expressed in the Constitution. It's not ambiguous. It's been described in numerous Supreme Court decisions and other decisions as plenary power the federal government has. This notion that a state can somehow assert its own immigration policy over the objections of the federal government is astonishing, astounding, not what the law says. But clearly, that is what the Attorney General of Texas is helping to advise the governor of Texas in what to do. Then you see these state AGs now, in the past week, they wrote a threatening letter to the state of Maine about the fact that the state of Maine was going to be making sure that people could access abortion in the state of Maine and gender-affirming care. And you have this threat letter coming in from these state AGs, you know, objecting to this, to the state of Maine, a state far from their borders, in essence, protecting the rights of people who are from Maine or come into Maine. Then you also have the story that you mentioned earlier, which really bears repeating briefly, which is the story that Politico wrote this past weekend about the organized campaign by these state attorneys general who owe their jobs in part to Leonard Leo to attack the Attorney General of the District of Columbia, Brian Schwab, for daring to investigate Leonard Leo based on a complaint that not only has Leonard Leo been involved in all these different ways, but the particular complaint was that the groups that he's now directing money to then turn around and hire his for-profit firm. And so in essence, he appears to be profiting from the donations that he's giving to these nonprofit groups that are also, many of them, involved in amicus briefs before the court. So you had two attorneys general in particular, the Attorney General Scrimeti from Tennessee and Attorney General Mayeres from Virginia, along with other attorneys general, threatening the District of Columbia for daring to investigate their buddy, Leonard Leo, and basically claiming if he investigates Leo, they're going to investigate every other progressive group on the planet. As if the other groups are engaged in any type of activity like Leonard Leo, that is not what's happening. That's not the case. But then when you look beneath the surface, you see, oh, ties between Leo and Scrimeti. Oh, wait, ties between Leo's longtime buddy at Judicial Education Project, Judicial Crisis Network, a guy named Gary Marks, who then had created a business in Virginia with Attorney General Mayeres before he became Attorney General of Virginia. So these tentacles really are everywhere, and it's genuinely outrageous and outlandish for these state AGs to be threatening another AG for daring to follow and investigate the law, follow the law wherever it leads regarding Leonard Leo. But these AGs are also deployed, as Politico wrote, as Heidi Presbilo wrote in that story, this whole operation is happening at the same time that Leonard Leo's for-profit firm, CRC Advisors, hires a lobbying firm whose focus is oversight by Congress. After that lobbying firm is hired, then suddenly Chairman Comer and Chairman Jordan on the House side decide that they're going to investigate the Attorney General of D.C. So basically, you know, a 1-2 punch. You have the AGs attacking the D.C. AG. Now you have Congress attacking the D.C. AG. And then, as Heidi uncovered in that story, you have one of the core Leo groups making a $250,000 donation to the leadership PAC that supports these same House members the day after the subpoena was threatened against the DC Attorney General. So it is affecting our lives, and it's infecting the integrity of the law. It's infecting a legitimate law enforcement investigation by a duly elected Attorney General in DC who is investigating their benefactor, Leonard Leo. And this sort of swirl of what, in my opinion, is corruption is so massive and stinks so badly. And yet, in the cacophony of awfulness that we're seeing, you know, from all sorts of quarters, it hasn't yet penetrated the public consciousness of why they should be concerned about what these state AGs are up to. But people should be very concerned because they are up to all sorts of no good, in my opinion.
Follow the money. But if you cannot follow the money, follow Lisa Graves. Lisa has been watching Raga's rise, as she said, for over two decades. She is founder and executive director of True North Research, a national watchdog group that works to shine light on the dark money that is fueling regressive agendas, targeting courts and schools. And she is really one of the nation's foremost experts on these massive, massive mental maps of things that seem awfully complicated, but somehow always end up in Leonard Leo's pocket. Lisa, thank you so, so much for being with us. This was a lot, but nobody could have done it better than you. Thank you.
Oh, thanks, Dahlia. Thank you so much for having me on, and thank you so much to your listeners for caring about this. I have tremendous hope that we're going to see our way through this ongoing crisis, but we have to know what we're up against in order to prevail. So thank you for shining a light. I really appreciate it, Dahlia, and just an honor to be on your show.
And that is a wrap for this episode of Amicus. Thank you so much for listening in. Thank you so much for your letters and your questions. And Amanda from Cincinnati reached out this week with a really thoughtful note in response to last week's episode where we spoke to Carrie Ann Baker previewing the Mifepristone case. Amanda writes this, quote, "It's possible to use appropriate terms to characterize early stage embryos, which are very tiny and do not look like baby humans, without minimizing them in an offensive way," end quote. Amanda was referring to the part of the conversation in which we discussed Judge Ho's concurrence citing aesthetic injury. We actually shared Amanda's email with Carrie, and Carrie had this clarification that we also wanted to share. Quote, "I actually worried a bit when I said that. My comments occurred in the context of talking about the aesthetic injury to the plaintiff doctors, which is why I said you can't see a baby in the first trimester. I know that people feel very sensitive on this topic, especially people who have had miscarriages of wanted embryos in early pregnancy. When I said, quote, there's nothing to see, I meant you can't see a baby, not that there's nothing there, but I can see how people would think I said the latter," end quote. Carrie wrote about this in a piece for Ms. Magazine, and we've linked to her article in the show notes. Thanks to both Amanda and to Carrie for your emails. You can always keep in touch at amicus@slate.com. Sara Birmingham is Amicus's senior producer. Our producer is Patrick Fort. Alicia Montgomery is Vice President of Audio at Slate. Susan Matthews is Slate's Executive Editor, and Ben Richmond is our Senior Director of Operations. We'll be back with another episode of Amicus next week. Until then, hang on in there.